Welcome to the Research Works podcast, brought to you in association with Curtin University and the Healthy Strides Foundation. Your hosts are Dr. Dana Poole and Dr. Ashley Thornton, and together we will interview world-leading researchers in the area of child health to support your practice in being more evidence-based.
The team at the ResearchWorks podcast acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land and waters on which we live and work. We pay our respects to all First Nations peoples, elders past and present, and would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we record this podcast each week, the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation. We recognise their continued connection to this beautiful Budja we call home.
Hello, everyone. I'm so glad once again that you decided to join us for another episode of ResearchWorks.
So am I, Dana. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
And hello to our very special guest on the show today. We have the fabulous Dr. Anna Carolina De Campos. Welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me. This is so exciting and so much fun.
Well, thank you for coming back on the show, Anna. We're so excited to have an opportunity to speak with you again. It's been actually a few years now since your last episode. For those who have worked their way through our back catalogue, or for those who are, you know, listeners right from the start, you joined us for episode 26 of the podcast, which was a really big conversation and actually a hugely accessed episode.
It was,
so
yeah,
that has reached a lot of people. And so we're so excited to have you back today. And thank you for coming on and representing your fabulous team. We know there's lots of previous guests who make up the team of people that you work with. So people like Egma Longo, Claire Schrader, of course, Ginny Paleg, who's a friend of the show.
Yes.
And the paper that we're going to talk about today was published in Developmental Medicine and Child Neurology. The title is F-Words and Early Intervention Ingredients for Non-Ambulant Children with Cerebral Palsy, a Scoping Review. So before we get into that, let's tell our listeners a little bit more about Anna. Anna Carolina De Campos is a professor in the Department of Physical Therapy at the University Federal de São Carlos. Her publications are incredibly holistic. They cover rehabilitation, neurodevelopmental disorders, rehab medicine, cognitive development, and of course, physiotherapy. Anna presents her work with some true and incredible leaders in our field, and the way that her work embraces the ICF and the F words really demonstrates her passion and dedication to knowledge translation around the world.
Oh, so good.
So good.
It really is so good. It's so good.
So now that we know you a bit more formally, Anna, let's get to know you a bit more informally through our icebreaker question. And our question today is, what is your favourite fragrance and why? And that was really just a nice way of me saying, what's your favourite smell?
Yeah, I never really thought of this before. The thing that came to my mind, and I think it has to do with some childhood memory, it's the smell of coconut when it's roasting. I don't know if you've smelled it before, but it's really good. And it reminds me of maybe one of my favorite candy when I was a child. It's a traditional Brazilian thing called cocada. So that's it.
Oh, wow. Anything to do with coconut is always a winner for me, actually.
Me too.
So good. Oh, sounds like that's something we need to try.
Me? Yeah, I agree. Next, we'll just have to have a trip over to Brazil.
Would love to.
Yeah.
That's a really good one. Now that you said coconut, all I can think about is coconut. Everything, like, it's amazing what smells do, right?
Yeah.
I was going to say vanilla, but nah, coconut still trumps it. I love the smell of herbs, you know, in spring, like it's springtime here in Australia at the moment. So when you go in and you can just smell herbs, you're like, oh, it's so, so good. It's because of all the dishes you can eat.
Yeah.
But I really love puppy breath. Like, puppy breath is pretty spectacular. I don't know if it smells great or whether it's just because you know that breath smell is a puppy and I love puppies.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
Do you know what I mean?
Because it's like, I feel like that about like little baby's breath.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, I wouldn't say it's a pleasant smell, but it's just like a smell that is
precious.
Yeah, that's the word.
Yeah, maybe
for it.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
So there's
that
food.
Was my second thing.
Yeah. Okay. We're on the same page here. I like it.
Yeah.
What about you? Was that your answer or did you have something else?
It wasn't actually. Okay. When I was thinking about this question, I was taken back to my childhood. So my nana used to wear a very specific perfume. Oh. And so the smell of that perfume takes me back to being a child. Yes. And, you know, all those wonderful memories that you have of your childhood and spending time with your grandparents. So yeah. That's whenever I smell Chanel No. 5, she's got very good taste.
Yeah. Classic.
Yeah. I love
that
smell.
Really cool. That almost like reminds me of the scene from Ratatouille. Yeah. You know, when Appetite, when he tastes the ratatouille itself and he goes back to his childhood and you're like, there are smells that do that to you, don't they?
Definitely.
I'm a bit hungry and I want to hug a puppy.
I need some coconut.
Ooh, yum. All right, I might go get some frozen coconut yogurt later. Some toasted coconut on the top. Oh. That sounds good. You've inspired me.
Before our tummies start rumbling, maybe we should get into the paper.
Let's do it. All right, let's tell you a little bit about what we'll be talking about today. And it's not just about smell. In fact, I don't think we'll be talking about smells at all. Yeah. So the aim of this scoping review was to explore the ingredients of early intervention provided to young children with cerebral palsy classified within GMSS levels 4 and 5, as well as to identify the F words addressed by the interventions. So of the 87 papers that were included in the review, it was found that fitness, family and functioning were the ingredients that were most addressed in experimental studies, whereas fun, friends and future were rather scarce.
Mm. Thank you for that, Dana. I'm really excited to get into the meat of this paper.
Yes, indeed.
But before we do that, Anna, can you start by talking through some of the unique features of children who are classified within GMFCS levels 4 and 5?
Sure. Yeah, I think the first thing and that has led us to look further into this subgroup of CP kids. Isn't there really forgotten in research? Mm. When we look into all those high quality studies with clinical recommendations for interventions in CP, we don't really see them there. And I think this speaks a little bit to the podcast we had before, the conversation we had that time.
Yeah.
We want to promote evidence-based practices. And when we look into the evidence, we don't find it for those kids.
Yeah.
So that's what our main motivation and an important feature for us to think about, because no kids should be left behind.
Yeah.
And do we see any differences in children who are born in high-income countries compared to low-income countries?
So, yes, actually, there are several epidemiologic studies suggesting differences in the prevalence among countries, especially towards having more children at GMFCS levels 4 and 5 in low and middle income countries due to a variety of preventable causes that are more prevalent in these areas and that typically lead to more severely involved children.
Mm. And for people maybe who aren't so familiar with cerebral palsy and the GMFCS, could you just, I suppose, give us a bit of a picture of how these children present clinically?
Mm-hmm. Yes. The main feature, the defining feature, is that they're are non-ambulant.
Mm.
Those at GMFCS level 4 may sometimes be able to use stepping devices, but they're not ambulatory in their communities. And those at level 5 are not either. They're typically other people conduct them. So this is the defining point. But also, it's classically those children have more comorbidities, for example, visual impairments, mm-hmm. respiratory and feeding issues as well, among several others.
Mm. Yeah. And I think that's such a unique feature of this group of children. And when, as you describe it already, you can sort of understand why, you know, the research really hasn't gone into that area yet. Because it's so, when you want a high quality study and you want to control and have as much of a homogenous group in each,
yeah,
it's really difficult to do so when there's a variety of comorbidities and how do you actually compare? And we all know that seizures can really affect function. Mm-hmm. So if you have a group of children who've got more seizures than the other, well, you'll probably affect overall outcome, isn't it?
Yeah. And if you are...
Yeah. And this is probably the reason why we see a publication biases.
Yeah.
But towards not including those children in research. Mm. It is challenging. Yeah. We acknowledge that.
Yeah. And I imagine for families as well, you know, if you have a child who is trying to manage seizures, visual impairment, feeding difficulties, it's probably quite challenging to then add participation in research.
Yeah.
On top of that as well, you know, there's so many competing priorities in how you manage their health and well-being that it's always tricky to add something else into that mix, isn't it?
It really is. And I think we saw a little bit of that in the early intervention clinical recommendations paper with Kathy Morgan and the team, and how they were saying in the early years there is a lot of this, you know, neuroirritability and in the first few years of life too. But we know early intervention is so important, which kind of leads me to my next question, Anna, is what are, if you could sum up what the current recommendations for early intervention are, I guess, in general, and perhaps maybe specifically for children of GMSS levels 4 and 5?
Right. So in general, the recommendations currently state that all children should do active interventions. They should be family-centered, context-based. This is general, but there's a lot of questions about how can we deliver these types of interventions, for example, being motor active if the child has a poor motor repertoire. Mm-hmm, so this is the main question we get from clinicians when we start talking about children who are non-ambulant.
I think that is so true, because I think the translation of talking about, okay, so the child initiated, active, promoting active engagement and participation, you can make that link so easily in children who perform within GMS levels 1, 2 and 3. Yep. You can see that. And of course, cognitive ability plays a role in that too, right?
Yeah.
But for limited motor repertoire, you really need to start thinking outside the box. And I guess if you're saying that there's this... a publication bias and there's less evidence-based interventions really specifically for 4 and 5, could we say that there's more children that are classified within GMS level 4 and 5 accessing more typically non-evidence-based interventions, or are they not really receiving much intervention? Like what do you think is happening?
So there is evidence saying that they receive less evidence-based interventions. I've seen also publications showing that they have more unmet health needs, not much about therapies specifically, whether or not they receive more or less therapies.
Yeah.
At least I'm not aware of it, but I would think that if they receive the same amount, it tends to be more passive interventions and not... They're not actively engaged as we would expect to be based on current recommendations.
So, Anna, given all the challenges in delivering interventions to this group of children, what do you think should be the focus of the interventions that we are working on with them?
It's not simple, and that's why we chose the efforts framework that we're work on in this paper, because the health needs are complex, and we have a lot of things that we need to think about. And I think this framework gives us an opportunity to think about all these complexities of their health condition and make sure we can promote the best available for each of those areas. So I really cannot think of one thing that should be the focus, but a broad and comprehensive view is probably how we should go around this.
Yeah. I like that.
I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think when we're going back to, and we're going to delve into a lot more here, but when you think about this group of children, you can sort of see why, you know, there's some of these, I guess, the more below the worth it line interventions, who are more passive, they developed, you know, 40, 50 years ago when people were trying to find a solution, but not really understanding how the brain actually learns. And more, I think I've come to the realization, I think I always knew this, but more and more papers are saying, you know, we all learn the same.
Yep.
Like that paper we spoke about with Yannick with the brain activation, we all learn the same way. So there we have these interventions that 40 or 50 years ago was very much about handling, because it's a hard group of children. So you want to passively move them because there's not much active repertoire. Yet we're also now faced with the fact that we know that the brain, how the brain actually works, and it needs active movement. And so there's the disconnect there, right? And that's where it doesn't. It doesn't line up.
Yeah.
So I love how you guys just gone, okay, let's look at the F words, because again, kids are kids, and the F words are,
it's a universal about being, language.
That's right. Yeah. I really love it. That was a long way around to it. But
but and it's, if we think about the motor repertoire, then I would say what we should think about is how we can adapt things so they can be actively engaged. And how they can feel have the sense of accomplishment and feel motivated that they can do things. And of course, we can only be successful with this over time if we pay attention, for example, to preventing musculoskeletal issues, because they will be limiting in the future. So and that's when we start to embrace all those words.
And I guess that's the shift again, isn't it? It's less about trying to fix the child and, you know, get them to move more. But they, at the end of the day, they do have a motor disorder. There is spasticity, there's dystonia, there's hypotonia. And we do need to look more about how can we change the world so that they can be more included. And again, F words comes back to that, doesn't it?
So, Anna, this study that we're talking about today was a scoping review. Why did you choose that particular design?
We really wanted to give a larger step and make clinical recommendations. But when we started to look into the available evidence, we realized that if we went to a systematic review, we would end up with very little material to make recommendations, and probably not sufficient quality for making recommendations at this point. So we thought we would start with a broader approach, trying to see what's out there available. And we were very open to including studies, even though they did not only include children at GMFCS levels 4 and 5, but if they say the intervention could be applicable, we would include the study. Because really we wanted to map what's out there and start to at least selecting what's promising, what should be further investigated when we design high-quality studies in the future.
Yeah, I really like that.
Yeah, and it comes back to what you were saying before about the publication bias. You know, if you're looking, you're taking a systematic review approach, then all you're going to, you're not going to answer your question, because you're only finding those articles that are, you know, focused on GMFCS 1 to 3, as we said earlier. So with that in mind, what was your main, the main question that you were trying to answer with your scoping review?
Yeah, so we wanted to map the interventions that are available for children who are non-ambulant. We wanted to target the younger children, so we target 0 to 5 years of age. Sometimes, actually very often, if the children, with the younger ones, it's not possible to know whether or not they are GMFCS levels 4 and 5, so we had to discuss strategies to decide the risk for them to be non-ambulant in the future. So we were really looking for those scoring below 2 standard deviations in developmental assessments and other predictive instruments that are available now, but of course not many publications using them just yet to predict the future risk. So we were mapping out what's available for young children who are at high risk to be non-ambulant. And we wanted to explore what are the ingredients of those interventions. We had to develop methods to refine our understanding of what are ingredients of interventions, and then developing methods to trace them to the F word. So it was really several steps, and for this reason, it took several years for us to complete this study.
Wow.
I know why.
Wow. Even as you describe it, I'm just thinking of all the work that would have happened within that. Mm-hmm. And even by the end of it, you would have had to probably do another search just to make sure you didn't miss anything. And that would have been like, oh no, what else are we going to include?
That's always the nerve-wracking bit of a review, isn't it? When it gets to the point where you have to redo your search,
yep,
and you're just crossing your fingers that there's, you know, obviously you want to see new evidence coming out, but not too much.
Exactly.
Well, thank you for doing this work, because we're always so grateful that teams do decide to do this, because not everyone can.
No.
And that's amazing.
And for all of the details, I suppose, on those, the approaches that you took, you know, in terms of mapping and the tools that you used to do that, all of those details are in the paper. So we would encourage everyone to, you know, follow the link in our on the website to actually have a look at that in depth, because it's very impressive.
Yeah, there's actually one publication that is the protocol for that, that has more detail than we could add to the DMCN paper.
Yes.
So we described a little bit of the crazy steps we took.
Well, I'm really excited now, because I really want to talk about the results, and we've left a lot of time to delve into them. And I guess we'll just talk about the results alongside some of the recommendations. It's probably the best way, because there are a few F words to go through. Mm-hmm. But maybe first up, what was actually included? How many studies were included? What kind of studies were they, I guess, in summary?
Right. So we ended up with 87 studies. It's a lot. And they were very heterogeneous, because we did not put any cutoffs in terms of quality or design. So we had qualitative studies, quantitative studies in of different types. 19 of them were RCTs.
Wow.
So there are, there are good quality studies. Several of them scored high in the quality assessments.
Wow.
So it was good to dig and find those studies for us. So, but they're very heterogeneous. One thing that we like about it is that we think, even though most, as expected, come from high-income countries, we found several studies that come from low-income countries as well. And this is important for us from the beginning, because we are a multi-country team. We wanted to make sure that we summarize what's out there, not only high-income country, but all around the world. So we have an idea of the challenges that need to be dealt with.
Absolutely.
That's where it's so unique, isn't it? Yeah, it's really great.
Yeah. And there was, you know, when I look at the numbers, we look at the breakdown of low to middle income countries in terms of the papers that you found, there was almost half of them, you know, 37 out of the 87 studies that you included were from low to middle income, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. And it was nice, because we see that people are, based on the resources that are available, they are trying to come up with ways to promote better care for children who are more severely involved.
So, Anna, let's dive into the F words in the context of your results, and to help us, I suppose, get a bit of an understanding of the F word intervention ingredients. So let's start with functioning, shall we?
Good place to start. Good place to start, yep.
Yeah, so tell us a bit about what you found in terms of the key ingredients, intervention ingredients that focus on functioning.
Yeah, okay. So for functioning, we found that goal-directed training is an ingredient that is feasible for children who are non-ambulant.
Great.
So this is there among the ingredients. And a child-initiated movement, so everything that's active, even if it needs to be adapted so the child is able to initiate the movement, so that's on functioning too. Interventions that promote the practice of the routines or routines-based interventions. Uh-huh. And because we did, we didn't only focus on motor interventions here. So we found, for example, some beautiful studies showing that, for example, for children who have challenges in communication, it's also possible by adapting and by bringing assistive devices for them to have self-initiated speech. Mm-hmm. So, and this is also so functioning. Yeah. We tend to think of the motor, motor function
at a good point.
First place, because at least because I'm a PT, but not only this.
Gosh, and that is so great that you found that, you know, goal-directed training, self-initiated movements, and the breadth of things that you found there is possible to do in this population, which we've often thought about is very passive in their movements.
Yep.
But if you do modifications, you can still get active, child-initiated, which is really what we're all after.
Yeah. And all the downstream effects of that as well. Like you think about being able to self-initiate and explore your environment in a self-directed way, all the benefits of cognitive development in that as well.
Yeah.
So that's one of the greatest things, because we know how the brain learns and we know how things are interconnected. The more motor experiences we promote, the more chances the child has to develop socially, cognitively, and they can't miss this.
Yeah. Wow, I love that. And that links really nicely to all the stuff we've been talking about recently.
Absolutely.
Mobility, being a human right.
On-time mobility.
On time. Yeah. It's really, really beautiful. Goodness me. It's like we planned it. So that's a really good one. So that's functioning. The next one is family. So tell us a little bit more about family, what some of the active ingredients or intervention ingredients were for that domain.
Right. So in family, we found so family-centered care as the main ingredient, and encompasses many different types of interventions. And things that, for example, home programs, home enrichment, and things that involve the family, and the family is able to deliver the care. So this has been very highlighted in the studies and as an important point. And parental education. This was a beautiful finding of this study too, because it's a low-cost intervention. It's available for high and low-income settings, and it's really able to promote magnificent changes in outcomes, both child and family related outcomes. We found some studies, for example, showing that at the beginning families have no idea how they should feed their children, and for children who have dysphagia, it's very important for them. Nutrition, it's a very critical aspect of their health. And very simple intervention targeting family education is able to change feeding and health-related, other health-related outcomes, very critical for the children. So these are very simple. A few sessions have a great impact.
That's really empowering for families, isn't it? Giving them the tools to, manage their child's needs and to feel confident in doing that. I think that's really powerful.
I think so too. When you think about the applicability of it and how that can be done anywhere, and if there are resource limitations, we've spoken to people previously about groups and being able to support families through that. There's just, I guess we just can't underestimate those beautiful opportunities of interaction where you are providing education and support.
Yeah.
It's not all about the therapy session. Those conversations are rich and beautiful.
Yeah. I think that's a really important point for therapists. Like you say, it's not, families coming to you for a session doesn't just have to be a session that focuses on the child and their, immediate needs. It can be a session that focuses on the family and empowering the family to do it together through things like coaching and education.
It's so good. That's really, really encouraging. I love it.
Fitness.
Oh, we love fitness. Actually, we love all the F words.
We love all the F words. You can't pick, it's like choosing a favourite child, isn't it? Yeah. You can't pick a favourite F word.
So I've got some favourites still coming up here.
Same here.
There were quite a few papers or studies, I should say, that focused or had elements of fitness in them. I think there was, you know, maybe
the highest one, I think,
was it 3/4, 60 or so. Can you talk to us a bit about the active ingredient or the key ingredients for interventions on fitness?
Yeah, so they were a majority, and they included not only those techniques, the traditional ones that target motor control, but also several other outcomes related to body structures and functions. So, for example, muscle skeletal health, feeding, sleeping, and digestive outcomes as well. So it was, they were very heterogeneous. They have several coincidences with functioning as well, because the same things that promote functioning, so self-initiated movement, child active intervention, it also promotes fitness at the end, because active muscles, they develop differently from muscles that are not active, right?
Yeah.
And this is very important, because the children who are non-ambulant, even though contractures and deformities develop later on, muscle changes are actually present very early in their lives.
Yeah.
So the soonest we start to think about fitness and promoting opportunities for them to move actively, the better. So this is an important point we make when we were discussing fitness ingredients. So we try to, we don't want to go into fights again. So we try not to focus on the things that are under the worded lines. We tried to highlight what's above the worded line. We want to spread the word on what can be done. And again, here, adaptive equipment was a very important finding in this study, because it actually standing, stepping devices, adapted seating. So these are all strategies that help children who are non-ambulant to stay fit, to meet their physical activity goals, because we have guidelines for that. And it's so hard for the children who are non-ambulant to meet the physical activity goals. But if we think that if they remain seated, if they stand in a standing device, this is all promoting activity, higher activity level than only lay down. So these are important points for promoting physical activity too.
You're speaking our language.
We love this. and I couldn't help but to reflect as you were talking about that. It's that whole 24-hour approach when you're talking about fitness. You know, you're looking at spasticity management, orthoses, muscle strengthening, bowel function, sleep. And because we know that function and fitness, being physically active, are so related. And I was talking to Dr. Sue McKay the other day, who again, another friend of the show, and she was talking about, you know, how about we think about comfort? And comfort really encompasses a lot of that for our children.
Yeah.
And fitness is a big, big, big part of that. But I love that a lot of people are looking into that. And those are things we should be focusing on.
Yeah. And not just for the physical health benefits, but for the mental health benefits as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, right. We just totally understudied. So we didn't show up in this review, but something,
Now, the next few F words were found less so in a lot of the papers that you or studies that you had reviewed. Fun being one of them with only 6. Talk us through that, because I feel like fun, childhood, they go hand in hand.
Definitely.
Well, all the way through life, really. You know, for young children, talk to us through fun. Yeah.
Yeah. So, childhood is about fun, right?
Yes.
We expect children to have fun. We expect them to be able to choose their games, to choose what they want to play. And for that, we need to be able to listen to them and give them the opportunity to show or say, if they can say or show somehow, what are their interests.
Yeah.
So we were really looking for studies where they say, well, the child was playing, this is the intervention, but we were looking for the studies where the child was leading the play and not the adult was directing the play. And this was very rare. And also, even though for the common sense, a certain intervention is considered fun, for example, a video game, that doesn't necessarily mean that the child wants to play with it.
Yeah.
So it's we need to go back and look inside us and ask ourselves, are we giving the children the chance to choose what they want to play? Or are we just directly and determining what they're doing?
Yeah.
And we need to start finding the tools that help the child to say what they want. Because we know it's challenging if it's a child with a cognitive impairment or communication challenge. We need to think about how we're gonna give this opportunity.
Yeah. And I think it comes back to what we talked about in functioning, and what I'm sure is, you know, a key characteristic in lots of other F words as well, being self-initiated.
Yeah.
So children will be drawn to the things that they find more enjoyable to do. So that's, you know, a relatively simple way of bringing the fun into it for them.
Yeah.
You're offering choices, but they ultimately get to choose where they direct their attention and energy.
It's so hard to be self-initiated if you're not given the chance to initiate.
Yeah. Right.
And make those choices. So really a good future goal would be to see the same number of fun with all of the things of functioning. Like, you know, if we're really aligning. That's such a good point, Ash. Really cool.
And it's totally central to neuroplasticity and learning.
It is.
They need to be engaged in. So it's central and it's totally neglected.
Yeah. And I love that already practically, you know, if you're a clinician or your family and our parent and you want to promote great opportunities for the child, fun isn't just, you know, a novel thing that you just, it's just fun.
Yeah.
If you can give the child some choice and opportunity to make a choice to do what they might want to do, you're already going way ahead.
Yeah.
And, you know, compared to doing nothing at all, you're giving the family and the child the opportunity. So it's worth a lot. There's a huge weight on it. Yeah.
And something that can be incorporated into lots of those other F words that we've talked about as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Really linked to the next one.
I mean,
they're all linked.
They're all
linked. I always say this, I'm like, but, you know, fun and friends, I think, are something that we think about a lot.
Yeah.
And that early years of building relationships, we see that so much. And, you know, turn taking, peer interactions, they start really early on.
Yeah.
What did you find for friends? I know this wasn't a lot of studies on this area.
Yes. So first, just sharing a little bit of the discussions we had when deciding the ingredients for that we would relate to this F word. We discussed the developmental aspect of being a young child and having friends, because we know that the youngest ones, they don't necessarily play with peers.
No.
But we discussed that what's a friend? A friend is sometimes a pet for a child or an adult. Sometimes it's a teacher or a neighbor or someone. Oh, so we decided that it has to do with social interactions, not necessarily with same age peers necessarily, but social interactions in general. So that's what we were looking for.
Yeah.
This topic is very dear to me because I'm very interested in participation and friends relates to participation as well.
Yep.
And what we see is that sometimes young children, people don't necessarily think about their how relevant it is for them to participate in different settings in their homes and daycare, if they go to daycare, in their communities, and having social interactions in these settings. So this is something that we didn't see a lot. And it's certainly something that needs to be more taken care of.
Yeah. And I like how you defined it, because particularly for this group of young children. So we're talking about 0 to 5, is it?
Yeah.
So for 0 to 5 year olds, like you say, a lot of it is just being alongside people. You know, they're quite focused on what they're doing, you know, and if they're playing, they're kind of playing next to each other rather than with each other. But yeah. It's having those opportunities to do that, particularly for this group of children.
It is.
Just being opportunities to be around other people and interact socially and develop those skills.
You learn so many cues from that, don't you? When you think about, like, I mean, hopefully good influences.
Yes.
But you're so true and right. Like, it's the, do they get a chance to go to the neighbor next door?
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of people are that neighborly these days. No. There's some neighborhoods where they are, where you would know who they are. You'd be able to interact with them.
Yeah. Does the family go for a walk to the park?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Going to the library and having those opportunities.
Exactly.
Yeah. Rather than being, I guess, the alternative is isolation, right? And not really being able to engage with the world. And I do like that in your paper, you do talk a little bit about, you know, some stigma that is associated in some, particularly in low income countries, about an education around what sometimes disability is and what it means for the family and for the mother. And that's isolation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So we were very shocked when we started discussing this, because in some communities, the families are really excluded from the entire family, sometimes excluded from the society, because in certain cases they're seen as a shame. In other cases they're seen as punishment. Mm. And so they hide, and the entire family hides, siblings hide. And this is very serious. This is unacceptable. And we need to... going to other efforts right now, looking into other factors that make that limit these opportunities too.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, that's the first time I've seen it written in a paper talking about that, but it's very real. And I know from the work that I do in other countries around Asia, is a very common, a very, very common thing.
Yeah.
And it's pretty heartbreaking.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And something, to be really mindful of. And I think, you know, just to, because they are all interconnected, perhaps that comes back into the family F word when we're talking about education and coaching and empowering families. Right. That's a really important part of it as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
So the last but certainly not the least important F word.
Yeah.
That we covered that you covered in this paper is future. So talk to us a little bit about future. Yeah. What does that look like when you reviewed all of these studies?
This was a very challenging one. Mm. We had several discussions. It took us a while to reach agreement on what are the ingredients for future. And we decided that, if you think about it, everything can change the future when you're working with a young child. But especially we were looking into prevention because we wanted to make sure that the things that can change or can prevent the negative outcomes that we know are possible and sometimes expected in children who are non-ambulant. So these aspects need to be considered early on. Mm. So intervention that can change the future outcome in terms of prevention were highlighted in this as ingredients in this effort. And also what we were just talking about, interventions that say that change the society, change the way the community sees the child, because this can have long-term impact. So the society that opens up for that young child to have social interactions is also more likely to provide education, to provide other opportunities for this child to thrive.
Yeah.
So we also considered all those empowerment and other intervention that can change the context as related to future as well.
Particularly at this young age, everything shapes.
It does.
Their future, doesn't it?
Yeah. And that's why it's so precious. That's why that time is absolutely so precious.
Yeah.
And a lot of us who have a role to play in that. I think you can look through all those F words and start to really think about those key ingredients that you can bring in when the opportunity presents itself, because they really do influence the future.
Yeah.
And they're really important for us to think about.
Anna, I think this paper is such an important spotlight on what we can be doing for children who are GMFCS levels 4 and 5. I think it really highlights where the gaps are in the evidence and where we can direct our efforts. But just, I suppose, making the F words accessible, but I suppose making sure that,
how we apply them.
That we are applying them all the children that we're working with.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a really important roadmap for that.
What would you say, Anna, would be your main recommendation to, I mean, of all of this, there's so much in there, but what would your main recommendation be for clinicians who are working with children at this age group and with this classification functioning?
One thing, just before I go into that I wanted to highlight is that we love the F words just like they are, but we felt like we needed to highlight the contextual factor beyond family, because the F words encompass family. And I just don't want to miss this, because I think it's really important. Not only all the environmental modifications, because we discussed them in fitness, in functioning, in several efforts. So this is contextual factor. This is modifiable. This is not fixing the child. It's fixing the environment.
Yep.
So it's certainly something that we need to think about. And thinking more broadly about the context, policies, referrals, intervention dose. So making sure policies are in place so that children receive early diagnosis, early referral to interventions. And in these interventions, they have all their needs looked at and considered. And among the available evidence, the things that thinking of future research, and even if I'm able to make one or two clinical recommendations at this point, even though the evidence is not high quality, is that let's promote education to families and let's promote environmental changes children can reach their optimal potential.
I'm so glad you raised that, because that's the context. We all are in different places. You know, some of us might be more in research, some of us might be in policy, some might be in management of a team. Those, like, we all have a role to play, and I love that you put that into that context. So, thank you so much.
And those are common goals that we can all be working
towards.
That's
right. Yeah. Really inspiring.
Mm-hmm. So, Anna, where to from here? What's next for you? And this, I know this work took a long time, so you might not want to go any further with it, but is there anything else that's keeping you busy at the moment?
Oh, yeah, but we need to move on, right? Yeah. We can't stop now.
Yeah,
no, that's right. You've got it started now. Here it goes.
Yeah, so we will find the way to... now, after this first start refining methods for a proper systematic review, perhaps opening a little bit our criteria so we are actually able to find more high-quality studies and start being able to provide formal clinical recommendations for this subgroup of children. This is a very important step, and it's highly needed everywhere we go. And when we talk about the current recommendations, people want to know that people are interested. They want to know what to do. It's just not there yet. So we need to start filling this gap. Probably one way that to address that is trying to work on a proper systematic review and on providing clinical recommendations.
Amazing. That's very
exciting. But I also have several experimental studies that I want to make. Hopefully we will help a little bit creating more high-quality evidence.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, those, that evidence will be very much anticipated, I would say.
I think so. Absolutely. We'll be talking to you again.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely, as I sequel. But, you know, we'll talk about the sequel in a bit. But for now, we do need to head into the next segment. I think he feels like he's missed out recently. I don't think we've always had a tell it to
Ed. That's true.
We didn't do it last time we were on the show, so we're going to make sure we make amends for that. So here we go. Tell it to Ed. Ed is our producer. He doesn't have a background in child health, but he has been listening, taking notes. He's looking very ready to ask a question. So, Anna, in about 60 seconds or so, I'll get you to summarize his research for someone who doesn't have a background in child health. And Ed, in turn, will have time for one question.
The boundary has been set.
Yeah, that's right. Take it away, Anna.
Okay, so when we think about children who have cerebral palsy and are non-ambulant, we need to take into consideration that they have complex health needs and do our best to address their needs. The main things that we want to promote is that the families receive the support they need so they can help the children develop, and all professionals, all stakeholders and everybody who cares about children with CP, think about providing changes in the environment so they have opportunities to develop and learn.
Beautiful. I can get behind that 100%.
Oh, yeah.
Ed, over to you.
Look, I've really enjoyed today's conversation, and I love that you've been able to identify a lot of active ingredients in interventions. And it comes across very tangible, very, very understandable, very, very practical. But I've realized that over 120 episodes that this kind of goes against the philosophy of some of the closed box systems that seem to be prevalent in the market, you know, the CMEs, the DMIs of the world, where their active ingredients are not necessarily scientifically identified, or it's very heavily protected, or it's hidden behind a paywall. And I guess today's question from me is about the fun F word. With some of these non-evidence-based interventions, often I see online the concept that things like crying is normal for these types of interventions or therapies. And that seems to go against the whole fun F word. I'm curious, is it a case of like no pain, no gain, where, you know, kids have to do the things that they don't want to do because it's determined to be good for them? And is this determination for the child? I know you touched on that, and I find it hard to understand that in these kind of interventions that a child with a neurological condition or injury might not be able to communicate how not comfortable or how much discomfort they might have in these therapies. So all this seems to go against the concept of fun is essentially what I'm getting at. I'm just wondering how that...
A long-winded way of getting there, but yeah, I get there.
pain and fun. Is there a...
Can they coexist?
Yeah.
Over to you, Anna.
I am so happy you asked this, because this is so unacceptable. This is unacceptable for adults. Why would it be acceptable for children? They have rights. We're violating their rights. Mm. So they have their rights. It's actually written down. They have rights to... leisure, they have right to education and health, and these things are not separated. Mm. They should be together. And fun is a fundamental right for children. We need to protect that, otherwise we're totally failing. Mm. And I'm also glad you're talking about the black boxes, because this is one thing we actually mentioned in the paper. Mm. We wanted to talk about ingredients and clearly say what's in the interventions, and because we don't like the proprietary things. I think, especially thinking about low research, we're again violating the kids' right to receive the high quality treatment that they deserve.
Yeah, it's a really good point.
Gosh, even as you describe it, it makes me emotional, because it's right. It's so true. Like, we talk about mobility being a human right, and I've loved that's been brought to the forefront, but kids actually do have rights.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. And that's so true, Anna. Yeah.
And the right to enjoy what they're doing, not be subjected to doing things.
Yeah.
Because they might not be able to communicate in the same way that we can.
Yeah. And that makes me emotional.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. That was very insightful, Ed.
Thank you.
Thanks for that, Anna. Gosh, what a great conversation. We're very aware it's very late in the night for you right now. We're grateful for the time.
We always are. Yes. Thank you so much.
Yeah. It's been so wonderful to connect
with
you again.
Thank you for the invitation.
Anytime.
Yes. Anytime. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for, you know, juggling everything you had to juggle to be here tonight, and we're going to let you go now and get some sleep.
That's right. And your son as well. I think your son in the background has gone to sleep now. Poor guy.
Is he has.
Fell fallen asleep. Yeah. Okay. Well, to all of our listeners, we hope you really enjoyed that episode as much as we did. We really encourage you to have a look at this paper. There's so much in there. So head to our website, researchworks.net, and we'll give you a link to this paper and where you can find it. And you'll see a copy of our show notes as well. Was there one more thing?
Yeah, and we have translated it to several languages now.
That.
So yeah, make sure you find our language and disseminate it.
Beautiful, beautiful. All right, we'll find the links for all the different languages too. I did see that come up as well online, which is fabulous. So thank you everyone for listening. Remember CPD form there you can fill out as well. Keep this part of RecursiveOPD requirements, but we will talk to you all again next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye. Thank you.